This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
I think we're starting to become more aware. Some people are, you know, beginning to report more, but we still know that what we're seeing reported is only a fraction of what's out there.
That's Karen Romero of Freedom Network USA talking about human trafficking in the U.S. Details coming up.
Also, there is increased security around markets and places of worship in Nigeria's Adamawa state after a deadly bomb attack at a mosque killed at least 27 people yesterday. And the United States may cut aid to countries that do not support it at the United Nations.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: in Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic, there are reports of mosques and health facilities being targeted, churchgoers and a pastor being killed, and this only 3 weeks after UN soldiers aided Central African troops disarming local militias in an incident still clouded by contradictions. To explain the current situation, we have in studio French to Africa reporter Idriss Fall. Idriss, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is going on in Bangui today, and what happened yesterday to ignite the violence?
Today is calm. Today is calm, but yesterday in the morning, some armed people went and attacked church, Fatima Church, and according to our stringer in Bangui, they killed at least 20 people, 200 wounded. And after that incident in the afternoon, two Muslims were killed and a mosque were burned down. So that was the situation yesterday. But this morning, even the Cardinal Jodone Zapalainga, who had the Church of Central Africa, left Rome, Vatican, to come back to Bangui and made a call to say, people, we don't have a religious war here and people have to live together. The president himself, Faustin Touadéra, also went to the church of Bangui to say that this is an act of terrorism, and he promised they're going to catch whoever did it to bring him to justice. The same call was done also by Imam Omar Kobine Layama, asking people to stay calm. That is the situation today.
So take us a little back into the history of the situation. The CAR has faced interreligious and intercommunal violence since 2013, with Muslim Seleka rebels on one side, Christian and anti-Balaka militias on the other. And for quite a while, like from 2015 to 2016, there was like a quiet spell. Then last year, the surge in violence escalated. So what precipitated the surge?
Because, they have a rule, I could say, during a transition period where they organize election. Faustin Touadéra was elected democratically, but the armed groups, there are more than 30 armed groups in the country. They are not disarmed. Most of them are Muslim, called ex-Seleka. And on the other way, you have militias, Christian militias, who also pretend to defend the Christian population. And until now, the neighborhood called Kilometre 5, which is mostly Muslim, where you have the biggest market, had been targeted in last April, because there is a group there headed by somebody named Makhtar Nimeri. Himself, he is called The Force, that's his name. UN tried to disarm that group because they were accused of stealing money from local people. But we spoke with the Force yesterday himself. He said that his group never been involved in the attack of the church. Himself, what they want is to disarm, and they're still waiting. And a disarming rebel group may take a while in Central Africa.
So basically, things are, you're saying, are calm right now?
They are calm, but everybody knows that it's calm today in Bangui. Tomorrow you're going to have killings in Bosangoa, another day in Bria. But what we can say is better than what it was in 2013.
Thank you. French to Africa reporter Idriss Fall, thanks for your input.
Thanks.
The Nigerian government today ordered increased security around markets and places of worship in Adamawa State after a deadly bombing attack at a mosque. At least 27 people died in the twin suicide blast in the town of Mubi yesterday afternoon. The first bomb detonated at the mosque, then the second went off at a few hundred meters away as people fled the mosque. Police say about 60 people were injured. Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, filling in while President Muhammadu Buhari is out of the country, ordered the increased security in the region. Adamawa State has seen scores of deadly attacks by the Boko Haram Islamic militants who have been battling to take control of communities in northeastern Nigeria. Since 2009, a bomb blast in Maiduguri in nearby Borno State last week killed four people.
And a new generation of Nigerians working under the banner Not Too Young to Run is striving to take its place in the halls of power. A bill to lower age requirements for political offices will soon be in the hands of Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. Chika Odua reports from Kaduna State, where a 28-year-old woman is running for a state parliament.
Ndi Kato is publicizing her unprecedented intent to run for Nigeria's Kaduna State Parliament.
I'm part of a group of young troublemakers that are creating change in the nation as we speak. We want to see something happen, and we've decided that we're not going to wait for the government to do it. And then we're now taking a step forward, you know, where we're going to participate in politics.
More than 180 million people live in Nigeria, nearly half below the age of 30, but they are barely represented in political offices. Kato, who is 28, is among those who want to change that. And these young activists are seeing growing support for the Not Too Young to Run campaign. Hamzat Lawal is one of the campaign's founders.
I'm supporting Not Too Young to Run because my generation has been malnourished politically. Over the years, we've been promised of a lot, but nothing has been given. So our generation is a generation of broken promises. And I felt that it's our responsibility as activists and campaigners to bring that voice, to bring that voice to the front burner.
The campaign was able to push Parliament to pass a bill to reduce the age qualification for presidents from 40 years to 30, governor from 35 to 30, senator from 35 to 30, and House of Representative member from 30 to 25 years. Tony Nulu, a member of the Federal House of Representatives, sponsored the bill. It is waiting to be sent to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
I am very confident that Mr. President will assent to the bill. It's one, it addresses the injustice against the young people. Two, it reinforces or reemphasizes his commitment or his belief in the youth of this country. Thirdly, it's nothing but a compensation also for the young people that trooped out to vote him into power in 2015.
Activist Hamza Haruna supported Buhari in his 2015 election campaign, but he criticizes the president's recent comments describing Nigerian youth as wanting to benefit from the oil wealth without working, and that many have not gone to school.
Actually, he's not encouraging the youth, because even if a lot of the youth did not go to school, what has the presidency done with regards to the education of the youth?
But they criticize the president's recent comments describing Nigerian youth as wanting to benefit from the oil wealth without working, and that many have not gone to school. Poverty is rising, and many blame Buhari for the country's economic woes. Ndi Kato believes she can help solve some of these problems for her community.
If the president does not sign this bill, everything we are building, everything everybody's leaning on right now is going to go to flames.
Then she presses on, shaking hands and meeting voters. Chika Odua in Kaduna, Nigeria, for VOA News.
The United States may cut aid to countries that do not support it at the United Nations. A State Department report on UN voting patterns names 10 countries in particular, including three in Africa, Zimbabwe, Burundi, and South Africa, where officials are reacting defiantly and say they have the right to vote according to their own interest. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley made the threat to cut aid in a written statement last week. But the reaction came this week after a long weekend of public holidays in Zimbabwe and South Africa. Haley said the United States pays 22% of the UN budget, but in spite of this generosity, the rest of the United Nations voted with us only 31% of the time. This, she said, is not an acceptable return on our investment. This transactional approach to international diplomacy has become a hallmark of the Trump administration. At the White House this week, President Donald Trump reminded Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari that the United States gives Nigeria more than $1 billion in aid each year. Trump then called on Buhari to lower U.S. trade barriers, saying, "We think we are owed that." Here's how Zimbabwe's government spokesman, George Chiramba, reacted to Haley's statement when asked. Zimbabwe, a longtime critic of the United States and the West, is already under heavy international sanctions anyway, he added. South Africa, which says it has good relations with the United States, has also voted against votes on international human rights abuses, often aligning with China, Cuba, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nduvuyo Mabaya says South Africa will not be swayed.
You can't do diplomatic relations based on bribery. If you do not vote for us, we will not give you money. It is the level of diplomatic relations that South Africa cannot be involved in. We are a sovereign state. We have got position on a number of issues. We have got our own national interest. We have got our own SADC and regional interest.
Once he stopped laughing, Chiramba explained why Zimbabwe so often disagrees with the United States.
Because we are Zimbabwe. We never pander to the foreign policy of any other power, whether it's America or any other power at all. We vote on the basis of principle.
Burundian officials, who have previously lashed out at U.S. attempts to cut aid over alleged human rights violations, said they could not comment Wednesday. Analyst Yaki Siliers of the Pretoria-based Institute for Security Studies said Haley's words are unlikely to go over well in countries that have long been courted by other powers, like China.
Money and diplomacy is never far apart. But the U.S. is the only country that really places this so firmly and publicly on the agenda, and that is that countries that do not support us in the General Assembly or elsewhere will not get money for development assistance through U.S. aid or elsewhere. And this, as I said, is a fairly common practice, but only the U.S. does this as blatantly as Nikki Haley has done. The other countries that do this are not well-known democracies. So it doesn't go down well in South Africa or indeed in Africa.
The United States provides hundreds of millions of dollars in aid each year to those three African countries. It goes, among other things, towards improving HIV/AIDS prevention, economic growth, agriculture, food security, refugee assistance, education, and maternal and child health. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A U.S. case involving the son of late Guinea President Ahmed Sekou Touré has put the spotlight on human trafficking for forced labor. Mohamed Touré and his wife Denise are under house arrest pending a court case for allegedly bringing a 5-year-old girl from Guinea and forcing her to work as an unpaid domestic helper and nanny for 16 years. The girl recently escaped. The couple has denied the allegations, and one of their children spoke in their defense at a court hearing. The International Labor Organization estimates more than 40 million people are modern slaves around the world. Karen Romero, Director of Training for Freedom Network USA, an anti-trafficking organization, says it is a bigger problem in the U.S. than most people know. She spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander.
Our network of partners and coalition members throughout the U.S., they have in the last year seen over 3,000 cases of trafficking throughout the U.S.
So why do you think the number is growing?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of root causes as far as push and pull factors when we're seeing trafficking cases. So we know that traffickers will prey on the vulnerability of individuals, and especially as we look at some of these cases where there are individuals coming to the U.S. with promises of jobs, of promises of a better life. We know that their home countries, oftentimes they're facing violence, discrimination, poverty. And as these promises are presented to them, obviously they seem like an ideal situation. And when they come to the U.S. And are trafficked, oftentimes they are not just forced, you know, or brought into a trafficking situation through force, fraud, or coercion, but they are, you know, there are different ways of control that the traffickers utilize to keep them, you know, within this trafficking situation, oftentimes taking away their documentation, isolating them from not just their family, but also from their community. They use their immigration status as a way of control by instilling fear and telling that individual that they will be deported or they're at risk of, you know, being in trouble with the law if they were to come forth. So there, I think if we look at all the challenges that are happening, you know, in this country, but also around the world, we can see the, you know, the high poverty rates, the violence that is happening in various countries. And as people try to find opportunities, whether it's in the U.S. or other places, there are, you know, that there's that need, there's those root causes that begin to open ways for people to enter into situations of human trafficking, especially as they're being exploited due to their vulnerabilities.
Is this a case of that there actually are a growing number of cases, or is it that we're just hearing about more?
Absolutely. So I think it can be a combination of both. As far as awareness goes, I think we're starting to become more aware. Some people are, you know, beginning to report more, but we still know that what we're seeing reported is only a fraction of what's out there because it's definitely very underreported. And there's a lot of fear and stigma around reporting this type of crime.
How does this rank among the cases that you've seen?
Seeing some of these cases and working with survivors in the past, I have seen the methods that traffickers have used in order to make the situation seem like it's the fault of the individual. And oftentimes the mentality that begins to form is that the trafficker, or whether it's a couple, whether it's an individual or a network of traffickers, that they are the only people that can keep you safe. And so if you were to reach out for help for law enforcement, you would be the one in trouble. And so there is this mentality that begins to form that the traffickers begin to groom these victims to think that it's their fault, that nobody cares. They begin to isolate them so they have no sense of community or no ability to reach out to family members. Oftentimes, if they have communication with family members, there are threats involved. And depending on the situation, some of those threats have been carried out, can be carried out. And of course, that's going to be a way of instilling fear and making sure that a survivor or a victim does not want to put their family at risk or their loved ones at risk. Therefore, they wouldn't dare try leaving or asking for help. In addition, oftentimes, I think more often than not, they are told that if they told anyone, nobody would believe them.
That was Karen Romero of Freedom Network USA speaking with our colleague, Paul Alexander.
Officials in Libya say at least 12 people were killed today when armed men and a pair of suicide bombers assaulted the Electoral Commission headquarters, dealing a blow to plans for elections before the end of the year. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the deadliest attack in Tripoli in 3 years, but speculation fell on Islamic State militants. Officials said the dead included at least 3 election officials and 4 security force members. The commission was registering voters for the election that many hope will unite the country. Libya has descended into chaos since longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi was forced from power in 2011, with rival factions battling for control. Elections were banned under Gaddafi. About 2.4 million of Libya's 6 million people had registered to vote as of a month ago. The commission building was heavily damaged in the attack in the Ghout al-Shal district west of central Tripoli.
U.S. lawmakers are calling for U.S. engagement in Libya to help reach a political solution and keep the North African country from becoming a springboard for terrorist groups. However, some experts doubt the Trump administration will play a leading role in Libya. VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi has the details.
Members of the House Foreign Relations Subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa warned that 7 years after the removal of former leader Muammar Gaddafi, Libya suffers from a power vacuum driven by civil conflict that could make it an enclave for terrorist groups. Chairwoman Elena Ruslatinen said Libya's instability poses a major problem for U.S. interests and called for a concerted effort from the Trump administration to include Libya in its priority list.
Libya needs U.S. leadership, leadership that can corral the various countries interfering in Libya, leverage our connections, and help push the political reconciliation process forward. I urge this administration to give Libya the attention that it deserves.
She says while the U.S. and the United Nations are supporting the government of national accord, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Russia are supporting the commander of the Libyan National Army, and Qatar and Turkey are supporting Libya's Islamist groups. She says such interference makes political reconciliation more remote and has stalled UN-sponsored negotiations. Lehtinen is calling for reopening U.S. embassy in Libya to increase U.S. engagement on the ground. Frederick Weary is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He warns that terrorist groups like ISIS could easily exploit instability in Libya and calls for a U.S. role in pushing forward the UN roadmap for Libya.
The U.S. and its partners must continue to play a strong, convening, and persuading role, especially among its regional Arab allies and also the Europeans, to support the UN-led roadmap.
Weary cautions that the parliamentary elections scheduled to be held this year, according to the roadmap, risk a return to strife if it is conducted without a constitutional framework. Alice Friend, a senior fellow at Center for Strategic and International Studies, notes that the U.S. should recognize that ending terrorist threat emanating from Libya requires a political solution.
The international community, including the United States, should have a patient and realistic approach to Libyan politics. The current challenge for the U.S. is knowing whom and how to engage among the constantly shifting array of power brokers and would-be national leaders.
She acknowledges, however, that the path to political solution in Libya will likely be a long one. Ambassador David Mack is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State who previously served in Libya. He says the Trump administration likely prefers others to take a leading role in Libya.
Particularly the European nations and Libya's neighbors that are most directly impacted by instability in Libya. If they were to take the lead in trying to reestablish some kind of stability in Libya, I think they would find that the United States would be supportive, but only in a support role, not a lead role.
Ambassador Mack says, given the range of issues facing the Trump administration, especially North Korea and Iran, it doesn't seem likely that Libya would be included as a foreign policy priority for the U.S. Mohammed Al-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari meets with President Donald Trump at the White House on Monday, April 30th. We'll discuss their meeting and current U.S.-Africa relations on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.